And we're recording, yeah. Good evening. Yeah, we're going to turn off our cell phones, if you would, please. Welcome to the Marxist School of Sacramento tonight. Everybody knows where the restrooms are and the escape route in case of catastrophe, other than, say, global warming.
Or, yeah,
the restroom's right outside to the left. And can everybody hear in the back or here? Good? Okay. So I'm Michael Manaski, and most all of you know me, so that's no further introduction needed. I'm the secretary of the Marxist School, and tonight we're going to talk about. Coffee's in the back, so we've kind of relocated things, and tea there, crumpets here. So help yourselves. Get up anytime you want. This is going to be freewheeling tonight. We're going to hear a discussion about, participate in a discussion about children, labor, and education. And it's going to be based on an article, I'm going to make preliminary remarks here based on this article that was written by our presenter, Dr. Bill Myers. And it's...
Bill.
Or Dr. William E. Myers, PhD, can children's education and work be reconciled? So, since a few of us have read this, I think I'm going to just summarize this 28-page tome here, or article, and it's going to take me about 6 to 8 minutes to do it, so bear with me. Okay. Children are defined by society legally as those persons less than 18 years old, and in some cases less than 15. Socially as participants in school and play. Psychologically as a group of developmental stages from birth to adulthood. And economically as a generally exempt from work in Western culture or deemed employable when the need arises in other cultures. Tonight's presentation and exchange is meant to raise questions about the nature of productive work, the role of children in society, the value society places upon education, and the web of interrelationships between these vectors. Unlike our pet animals, infants grow up to be compassionate and enlightened older adults, and our task is to see to it that this circle be unbroken and improved. The intended audience of this paper, published in 2001 in International Journal of Educational Policy, Research, and Practice, is academic and political, and therefore quite small. This is a very small audience. The hope is that the Marxist School will join that small audience.
It's might be a bigger audience.
And address the difficult problems that serve as obstacles to integrating work, play, learning, and living for children. For example, India suffers from some of the world's lowest literacy and school attendance rates. It has more working children of school age than does any other country. Some research shows that child work almost inevitably depresses educational participation and achievement. Poverty is more the problem than culture. Welcome. I'm just doing an introductory presentation of the article that will help inform us for this discussion. Complicating these facts, some research shows that child work almost inevitably depresses educational participation and achievement. Poverty is more problem than culture. Complicating these facts is that many working children abandon school less out of a need to work than out of disillusion with poor quality and conditions of locally available schooling. What is needed is work that is potentially formative and reconciles the need or desire to work with the child's right to receive a decent education. The United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, noted that productive work should be seen as part of the overall education process, that productive work should be part of the education afforded all children and not only the poor, and that the anachronistic dichotomy between manual and intellectual work be eliminated to promote social and individual development. UNESCO's policy is to make education systems more relevant to economic needs, to emphasize the dignity and value of manual work, and to integrate formal and informal learning. In addition, adults should be afforded education in the workplace while children are afforded the opportunity to earn a living while going to school. In the 1990s, the disintegration of international socialism and the ascendancy of globalized capitalism were a change in ideological tides. UNESCO's liberalized educational policies met firm obstacles. Institutional bureaucracies of schooling became more strongly centralized, while teachers resisted changes for new responsibilities for which they were neither properly prepared nor adequately paid. Is education with production a bad idea? There are three practical criteria to be met: social demand, good educational sense, and operational feasibility. The social demand is enormous. Educational sensibility, on the other hand, eludes educators as what most children learn at school is what is needed to succeed in school and to continue to further instruction. Institutions have enough trouble imparting just basic literacy and numeracy skills. There is strong evidence that children learn most naturally through supervised accomplishment of real-life problem-solving in an interactive environment. On the most globally social level, failure to learn is the result of exclusion from participation. But is the injection of productive work into the child's educational experience manageable? Implementation of such programs, especially on a large scale, presents serious obstacles. There is a long history of failure to integrate work and learning for children since UNESCO's ambitious policies were announced in the 1970s and 1980s. The solution to this problem is better understood of the relationships between work and learning for children and is found in studying its modes. There's an ascending order of complexity in developing learning with children's work, and they are described by differentiating the prepositions between learning and work. Learning without work is the current situation. Learning with work is the first mode and makes it possible for working children to receive an education. This mode takes education to children in the workplace, including sidewalk schools, and emphasizes the coexistence of work and study. The second mode is learning from work and focuses on the experience children have becoming empowered while working, drawing lessons from that work. The emphasis is upon consciousness raising and enables youth to work through difficult and dangerous situations such as police abuse, cheating by clients, and lack of washing and sanitary facilities. These experiences are particularly appropriate during middle childhood and early adolescence. The goal is to draw children into structured educational programs in small groups, but with an emphasis upon highly flexible, non-formal, remedial schooling. The idea is to allow children to retain the power of decision over their own lives, and the role of adults being merely advisory and facilitating. The difficulty in enabling this mode is that the participative and democratic group processes that run directly against authoritarian school structure and limited teacher competence in engaging flexible, non-formal rubrics. The third mode on this scale is learning for work and includes vocational and occupational training, which we are very familiar with. This approach is a staged process or run in parallel with formal schooling. Obstacles to this mode are the public expectations that white-collar jobs in the post-colonial periods in other countries, obviously the colonies, held high status and manual labor was frowned upon. Expense is a major problem, and solutions look to charging tuition from poor students and seeking scarce government subsidies. These hidden costs are not borne by those most benefiting from such training, the owners of capital. Finally, such institutionalized programs can overproduce the supply of skilled laborers and lead to underemployment and unemployment. The last and most demanding mode is learning through work, where work is so integrated into the child's experience that it becomes an educational mechanism in its own right. Children's learning is an apprenticeship in thinking and may be structured to provide for learning as well as production. Most commonly, this happens as unpaid child labor in the home. The advantage is that this work is valuable to the child as sensory motor experiences that use symbolization, such as natural language, simple drawings, and gestures. In Africa, children solve practical, economic, and technical problems related to work. Many missionary schools adopted an education through work philosophy. In Botswana, the Swenang Hill model engaged children in brigades, which generated learning and income. Unfortunately, these brigades failed to defray the cost of educating the children and required scarce public subsidies. Work comes in many forms, and some hinder human development. We do not well understand how the many variables in children's learning and work influence each other. One possible answer is a custom fit to children's circumstances. Another might be a proper analysis of children's play and the physical needs of the child. Sleep is undergoing analysis as a recognized in its absence as a recognized disorder that can influence the human body's immune system and be the cause and cure of chronic illness. Pediatrics recognizes the need to analyze the requirements, physical and emotional, of children as children and not as miniature adults. It's hoped that this introduction will put your minds in place to listen, participate, and question the knowledge and beliefs we have about work and children. As an introduction, William Myers is retired from the United Nations, where he worked with UNICEF and the International Labor Office on child protection policies and programs, especially those pertaining to children's work. He's an associate in the UC Davis Department of Human Ecology. He continues to publish on child protection in general with a focus on policy regarding children's work. With three other colleagues, he co-authored Rights and Wrongs of Children's Work, published in 2010, University Press, which provides a broad social and interdisciplinary view on the subject. Bill Myers received his Master of Public Administration and Doctor of Education degrees from Harvard, where he explored education and training for rural development. As a disclaimer, I've visited frequently with Bill Myers and his wife Nancy for the last 2 years in the Living Compassion Group and a contemplative practice group. I would be so forward as to say that Bill is my friend, and I introduce him to you as my friend tonight. Thanks. Bill Myers.
Thank you for putting that long speech.
I can't put it out again.
I'll shut up.
I passed up there for the table. I think everybody got there. So I'm going to more or less zoom through this. And the reason I put these other things up here is because it helps to understand why do an eminently sensible thing put kids' work and their education all together. Why has this already happened? Why is there resistance to it? What's wrong? Basically, if you take a farm kid in the States, a lot of school, I grew up on one, you did your chores, you worked out, helped out, went to school, did all of this stuff, and it was just no really big deal. And there always have been some issues, in places, cities, and so on, areas where kids, got pulled off, and they should have been going to school and they weren't, and so on. And we had mechanisms for handling that. And so but somewhere along the line, we got the idea that kids shouldn't work, it's somehow bad for them. And at an official level, parents haven't really believed that to the same extent, but officialdom has. And there's some story to that because it's sort of patently not very logical and not very true. And so, in a sense, how did we get there? And I want to go through that very briefly, because that helps us when we're going to talk a little bit about putting education and work together. Okay. The big divide is between ideology and empirical evidence as the basis for thinking about something. All through some social policies of all kinds, we have a whole lot of things. And we come at them from a history that we got from our parents and we got from our schooling and so on. Now, what about the ideological decisions, our way we construct the world and so forth? Then there are other things that we go to a university and we study anthropology or sociology or whatever, medical science. Then we sort of go out and we do analysis, we get the facts all in. And these two ways of thinking don't work very well together. So what do? We compartmentalize. So we have all the things that I would think over here, and I'm no different than anybody else. I have all these things over here, but which I have ideological positions, which I can argue you know, very very passionately with somebody, but I may not have the slightest idea what I'm talking about, really. I don't know, just know my opinion, okay? Then there are these things over here that I've studied. You know, I had to go do research and read other people's research. And they argue these from the standpoint of data. You know, and sometimes these two meet, and a lot of times they don't. And the one reason they don't is because it's uncomfortable when they conflict. In social policy in general, a good example being a policy for welfare policy, let's say. We have both of these things come together all the time. We have ideological positions of different types, and we have the data that comes out of sociologists, social welfare research, and so on, you know, and they don't fit easily in the same place. You know, the round peg just will not go into the square hole. So we sort these out. This is what's happened with thinking about children and work. Way back in the, you know, if you come from a union background, and I do come from a labor background, that's why I was doing it at the International Labor Office, you know, in Geneva. Okay, was we thinking about all of these kids in the dark satanic mills, you know, that they call them, you know, doing child labor and these things, you know, in the late 1700s. And we have this idea about kids all being exploited for the work and whatnot, you know. And that happened. I mean, there's nothing actually wrong with that picture. That really did happen, okay, and it shouldn't have happened, okay. And very logically, we've come over the years trying to get at that and keep those things from happening. But at the same time, you had all these kids on farms, you had kids growing up doing other things, kids learning trades. You had people learning to be plumbers and, you know, whatnot. And they learned these things from their parents or from their families, you know, or other communities and whatever they were. And this was how they made their living. To this day, most of the food that most people eat in the world was produced by people learning from their families how to produce that food. You almost can't teach farming in a school. Okay? Not only that, how do kids get raised? Almost everything we learn about how to raise children, from taking care of them from infancy, how to handle them in the house, we learn by doing, we learn from our parents, we learn otherwise. So in other words, we feed ourselves and we raise our kids according to what we learn, you know, out in society, from usually through households, usually through families of one type or another. There are many kinds of families in the world. There are kin, big kinship groups, and there are nuclear families that are small like ours. But this is kind of the fundamental human learning. And anthropology, you know, that has really taken a good interest in this and taken a look. And one of the leading anthropologists who's looked at this, who's at UC Santa Cruz, Barbara Rogoff, wrote a book in 1990 called The Apprenticeship in Thinking. And the reference to an apprenticeship like in a factory was on purpose. She said, we become human. We learn by working together with others, maybe adults, maybe older kids, whatever they are, to learn something together so we can join society. We're cultural animals, we learn to do our roles in it, and we learn it from each other. And when she wrote that book, it was so convincing that she thought schools would start working that way, and they didn't do that. But who did was Boeing. Boeing picked that up immediately, went up, started applying this to the training of people to build new aircraft, and they cut their training by a third. And got better results. By taking them out of the classroom, putting them side by side, letting them work together, and learning those through structured tasks, you know, and they learn. Because why? Because that sort of scientific view, that is the fundamental human learning mechanism. Classrooms, where you sit at tables like here, you know, and somebody talks to you, are actually not a very good learning mechanism at all. Why do we have them? Because that's like a factory. We learned when you had a whole lot of kids and you've got to keep the cost down and you want them all to learn the same thing so they can all go out, then you have to do it like a factory. But what we do is we give up learning combatant, learning is a situation in order to get efficiency. So we give up learning effectiveness to get efficiency, and that's why we have classrooms that we do now. That's a very, I mean, I'm always oversimplifying, but the point is that in a sense, we have been learning uphill for a long time against how our genes and our brains were put together to actually work. So learning through work, broadly defined, not as a job, but by doing things with others, is how we get to be human. Okay, that's in a nutshell. I want to make that clear. But the ideological view that comes to us from Black and those satanic, the dark satanic mills of the 1700s, through the labor movement, to which the successful century, when it went out of me, got the kids out, is the idea that children should not be doing work. Or at least they should not be doing work that is of certain kinds and so forth, okay? And so we have built up, for lots of reasons and lots of ways, including class and ethnocentric values, okay? That this is very Western, but you can't sell this in, say, Southeast Asia, okay? This view. So the idea is that we sort of have built up this whole framework in which we think we understand what the issue is, and don't understand anything about it. All we have is an ideology. So that's the very quick way to get that. What is a child? You know, by international standards, so you know, speak and talk to each other in the United Nations, there is one definition. It's anybody that's under 18 years old. Anyone that has not had their 18th birthday yet is by nature a child. But that means a 1-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 16-year-old are considered both all children. And any of us who have had any kids this age, we know they ain't the same thing. Okay. So we need something that, you know, better than that. And anthropologists and child development experts and people like that break these all down. And of course, we talk about children having different needs from different ages, you know, different stages and so on that are there. But that big thing about the international definition of up to 18 years old pays for child labor. Child labor, you know, by definition, is children working by, you know, before they're 18, okay? Now, there are a lot of things that go into being a child, too. A lot of children by 14 can do every single job, you know, that adults normally do in their society. Now, are they children? Okay, what happens about the girls who get married at 14 in our society? That they can do that, you know, and they become mothers. I mean, children are, you know, which they are, and in terms of some ways, you might say that the frontal lobes are not yet been developed, okay, if you want to take that point of view. But all of their roles in society, all their responsibilities, and all their privileges are now theirs, you know, let's say maybe 16 years old, but they're not yet 18. So you have different ways. You can have a legal definition, which is child is up to 18. You can have a functional definition, which is children act like children in a city of society, then they master all of the trades and so on, and they go to work. Just to give you an idea, who's the Russian that made the great fancy eggs?
Fabergé.
Fabergé made his first world famous egg when he was 14. Okay, and he had mastered the trade. I mean, he'd been apprenticing since he was young, you know. And so, I mean, he was a master at 14. I walked into a shop in Bangladesh and watched a boy freehand machine a screw for a printing press. You know, I mean, you know, no guys. And you know, I mean, theoretically, you can't do that until you're a master machinist. He was 16 years old. Okay. So in a sense, you have all these kind of different ways of thinking about what a child is. How about asserting responsibility? We in the West, on the whole, like to keep our kids kids. And we say, oh, you lost your childhood. The whole idea is that your child, at some point, you keep them there, and then over here, suddenly they're 18 and they're not brought, you put them on the street. You know, and they're an adult. And we consider something's wrong if you sort of let them be an adult too early. Most cultures of the world, I mean most people, have a different view. They think the whole idea of raising a kid is to ease the way in steps to adult, you know, responsibilities. And so they teach them, they open the ways for them, they give them opportunities to work and everything. So they learn little by little, you know, until they reach whatever age it is, so, you know, at that point, and they can do all the different things. They look at us, keeping our kids out, they say, these people are nuts. But because that's our way of doing things, we think, well, we should protect children's right to be children. Also, when these kids, like our kids, go out into the world, people look at it and say, what's wrong with them? They don't know anything. You know, and when we sometimes think that, you know, take the kid out, and so they go out and look for a job, they're not been prepared, they don't know what they are, stuff like that, and wonder what's wrong, why are they not prepared to get a job? Did we train them? Did we give them all these steps? Did we equip them? Okay. So these kinds of issues come up, and even what it means to be a child at that way. And who qualifies as one is very local and very, very situational. So who's a child in the U.S. is not the same as who's a child in the Philippines, for example. And who's a child in the northern well-off U.S. is not the same as who's a child in the south. No, in a, let's say in the bottoms, okay? So in a sense, once we get out of these legal definitions, we start thinking about that. Then we're in the question of what it means to be a developed human being, and to be a human being in development. And the move from something we might call childhood to something we might call adult, then, you know, is a whole gamut of different things. What's work? Well, is it the job? Well, how about artists? You know, it's not a job, really. You know, they're how about a writer? Anybody here a writer? Yeah.
Well, if you get paid.
Yeah, but so work, by definition, if you get paid, right?
Well, no, there's the professional workers, and then there's amateur workers.
So the amateurs aren't working.
No, they're right. Technically, they're just amateurs, uh-huh. Right?
Kind of like writer or an artist.
Did anybody ever read any Marx about work?
Yes, we have.
What did the great Marx say? Somebody want to tell me?
Hey, you're a Marxist about work.
Yeah, well, what did he say about work? Come on.
It's human activity.
He said it after that. He said it's an activity that makes us human. It defines humanity. So you're only human if you get paid, right?
Right. you don't feel completely and fully human until you've got.
No, that's very culturally defined. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
And very much this moment. An artist doesn't feel human unless he's creating, and he just feels hungry and isn't getting paid.
Yeah, what was wrong with stealing surplus labor from a worker, huh?
That's not a
reason. They're talking employer marketing to people, okay? What was wrong with stealing people's labor?
He says it isn't stealing. It's fair. It's the fair market value for the commodities.
No, he says not. He says what's wrong with it. He, you're right what he's saying. He says what's wrong with it. You're stealing their humanity. You're lessening their humanity. Because that's defined. The work is one part of what we do. We contribute to work, we pay ourselves and others, it's our contribution to the world, and if we can't contribute, okay, you know, if our contribution is appropriate by somebody else for their benefit, and we can't live from that, that's a form of stealing. But what stealing is an essential component of our humanity. Now, a lot of people in the world still believe that about the Marxists. The Christian labor movement, for example, was among the early ones. Remember that Marx separated from Hegel, is not let off because he was an atheist, okay? But a lot of other parts that came out of their labor movements, including one that was Catholic, who grew up in Italy, Spain, so on. It was all wiped out in World War II by the fascists, by the way, so they don't exist much anymore. But they also believe, and this is from a religious point of view, that work, okay, is a God-given right, okay, and the dignity of human beings, it's very close to ours, was based on the fact that we can work. That is, we can affect the world, we can take it, we can have options, we can have objectives, purposes, we can make things happen around the world, and that is work. And it doesn't depend on it being industrial. You don't have to be an industrial economy. You know, you don't have to have factories. You don't have to have any of these things. You don't even have to produce something to, in order to be working. That idea of work is much broader than work. Then the one that came along in the 1800s, and it really got possible in the 1900s, which was that work is something you do in industry. Now, I bring this up because when they start talking about child labor, what's wrong with it? The bottle, the box it's fit into, is a box that's industrial. If we think back to those Garxicanic mills, you know, as Blake called them, and we think about people that have, they work a number of hours, they get paid or not, you know, they do all these things. Then we want to guess what portion of industrial kind of work is done by children. Or you know what, how portion of children do this kind of work? It's well under 10%.
Is that worldwide?
Worldwide. Anywhere, really. The vast proportion of work done by children is done in or related to agriculture. Remember I mentioned about producing food? Most of the food that's eaten in the world is produced by people who learn how to do it. Almost all of it is working for nothing, for kin. Maybe parents, maybe other kin, brother. Very small percentage of children's work is paid work in anything that even remotely resembles, you know, a structured thing. Now, there's a lot wrong with that where it does happen, okay? And I made my career trying to fight what was going on. I just want to point out that child labor, when we start talking about children involved in that kind of stuff, is a problematic area which occupies a very small portion of children who work.
Bill, I have a question about brick making in Malaysia, let's say.
That's part of the industrial labor.
So are you calling that industrial work or
that's industrial work?
Yeah, because I'm
not wrong. Because they turn up, they get a wage, if you want to call it that. You know, that's under the industrial framework.
Even if they're doing it as a cottage industry, if they're
home. No, they're all in the case of bricks, they're almost always hired by somebody else. It's a hard thing for a family to do as a family business. Not that it never happens. On the whole, the brick kilns, especially Pakistan, which is the big problem area. These are owned by an owner as a business, and very often these are children of indebted parents. There's debt bondage, everybody knows what debt bondage is. You get into debt, then you might as well be in slavery. And very often these kids are using meals to pay off the debt. It's a very nasty thing, it's something that we're trying very hard to get rid of. Okay.
Thanks for clarifying. Are there other major industries that we can think of that might be kin work instead, you know, where that's blurred, that line?
Sure, a lot of countries, a lot of crafts are done. You know, the plumbers and the people who build houses and things are very often their family units, or kin units very often. We don't have in our society a kin structure like a tribe, okay? You know, or a clan or something. A lot of societies in the world, you know, they sort of have nuclear family like we have, but they have extended family. Then they have these things in between, you know, that are clans or tribes. Then they get up to a nation or something. We don't have these intermediate structures. A lot of economy and work in the world is structured around these intervening, let's call them, kinship, you know, kind of thing. So that puts it in a somewhat different category. We have to study those and look at them and see what they are. And some act exploitatively more like a firm, and some of them are very family and very protective. And you can find them side by side. It has to do with religions and throughout all kinds of things to get involved in that. Okay. It's very situational.
So does kin and ag, I'm sorry. You said that 10% of global work done by children is industrial. How does that break down in terms of ag work and kin work?
Oh, the vast majority is still in ag. Ag and the industrial sector, that's on the informal sector. The informal sector are people doing these kinds of work. They tend to be anything from small shops to small building, things like that, where they are not registered firms, you know, which they collect taxes. The typical, you look and see if they're on somebody's tax roll. And if they're not, they're out there in a slum or they're out there in a country and they're out just building stuff, that's called the informal sector. And it tends to be depending on the country, it gets to be, in most places, anywhere from half again as large to three times as large as the formal sector. That's changing because the world is getting richer. And as the world gets richer, in countries like China and India, more and more is being done in the formal sector and less and less is being done in the informal sector.
What about the percentage of industrial agriculture? How much food? How many children?
There is a problem in certain crops. Cotton. Mm-hmm. Cotton was one of the kids out there in the early 1900s. You know, the place like Egypt has had a problem with it. And then one place we love. Other kinds, it gets not only kids, it gets people out of it. You know, they have people raising something. They buy a big piece of land, bring all the equipment, and everybody goes out and causes mass unemployment in the rural area. And five or six people do the work that 50, 60 did before. And that, if you place like Africa, that's what's happening. So you do have cases where things like tea picking, there's been recently a big change in tea picking, but in Kenya, for example, kids, they have a terrible time getting schools out to rural areas. Teachers don't like to live in rural areas, and it's extremely hard to maintain rural schools in a lot of countries. And so what they did at the tea estate was actually put up some of the best secondary schools. So the kids would come and they'd work 6 to 8 hours a day, and they would get free schooling. And these schools were very good, by the way, okay? And they were very popular, but my organization at ILO thought, oh my God, we don't have kids, we have child labor going on out there. So they closed them all out, they closed the schools, and now you have the same kids without any schools. So in a way, it's a big improvement, but they can sell their stuff because as long as a tea plantation is trying to sell tea, and somebody can say that's being produced with child labor, it's not going to be on the market, so they can sell in the States, and they basically got rid of the schools. Okay. And there are no kids doing this now, so they've mechanized a lot of it. And nobody does a lot. So basically, that's what's happening in lots of places. In agriculture, I'm talking specifically in agriculture. This is off the subject, but this is not considered the most productive way to feed the world. The United Nations has put a huge amount of effort into trying to ask the question, how can we best feed the world? And their answer, in a very short, overly simplified, is that small farms, farming ecologically, using modern ecological techniques, which allow tremendous intensification of agriculture, is the best way to feed the world. They are very worried about bringing industrialized agriculture to places like Africa, which is being very expanded. So anyway, in that case, you would be a bit more labor. So then the question would be, should keep the kids. What is labor? Labor is an English word, and it's really hard to translate into most other languages. Arabic has it. Labor with its connotation of tedium, of hard, physical work, and so on, it's not the same as work, is not a general concept. In Spanish, or in Portuguese, or in French, or whatever, the same word is trabajo or trabajo. It's work and labor are the same thing. So when you start talking about labor, they're talking about trabajo, work, and they don't necessarily mean the same thing. So when we start going across these ideas to other languages and talking internationally, we run into real trouble on these things. So child labor, when you start talking about that then, is already, we have some problems thinking about children. In a legal way, up to 18. Okay, we have trouble thinking about labor, work, whatever it is. And what it comes down to is that child labor is a construct, meaning it ain't a thing you can look out there and observe it, unless you make your own definition of what you mean and then do it. It's a combination of some of the value judgments, not a good thing, labor, and a child doing it. But there's no such thing as you can go count, let the Dutch and Devon define it first. Let me tell you how hard that definition is. I'm going to read a list that I took when I was in the International Labor Office, and I was struggling with this issue, getting more frustrated by the minute. And I went to the bookcase, which is full of ILO books and others, and I took it, I went like this, I put the file on the desk, Then I started to, and I wanted to look up and see how these different authors define child labor. And I suppose I did this for an hour or two. I don't remember anymore how long it was. But in some small amount of time, here are the uses that I found. These are authors either defining it or assuming that in the way they were talking about the issue. It was all work of any kind performed by children, or economic participation by children. This is very common in the economist academy. Full-time work performed by children. Work that is harmful to children. Work that interferes with school. All paid work by children. Wage employment. You need a regular wage, to get a wage for the same thing.
Yeah, that was my thing.
Work that exploits children. Okay. Work that violates national child labor laws. Or work that violates international standards. And when I got to that end, I just closed up and I shook my head like when I put the rest of the pile away. I mean, I only got a little way through the pile before I even got there. And it's basically whatever the provider thinks it is. And in some of these cases, it was the same writer reading it different ways in different chapters, different places in the same book. There are, for the purposes of economists and their labor economists, there are certain standard definitions that they use, that they put together. They change them there's a committee that meets, and they change them every 10 years. That's for the academics, that's for them, but it certainly doesn't line up with what most people think. Johnny, you want me to work around this house, okay? Okay, the whole point is that it's a construct. In any given situation, we need to say what we mean by it. Now, that doesn't mean we can't use the word, use the idea. It just means each time we have to come back and say, for whom and what situation we're talking about. Now, what are we going to call a kid, and what are we going to call a work, and what are we going to call it? Okay? And if we ever have anybody that's not in the industry, because we have trouble using the labor idea. Okay? Basically, what this means is that we have lots and lots of varieties of what child labor is. And some of them can be grouped by the kind of institutions that tend to follow along. In one article that people use quite a bit, I picked up four examples. I've got about 8 or 10. Four of them make a point. One is a labor market approach. This is what the law used to work for. You look at labor markets up here, or kids participating in labor markets. This is a labor economist language, okay, a labor lawyer language. Okay? And we have conventions and rules about this, and so on that we make. But all thinking about the child labor is children in labor markets, which actually is an extremely small portion, although it's a growing portion, because most children are not in labor markets. They're not part of people who would be hired, people who hire somebody and you bring them in. The reason they have this is they're worried that children, if they're in labor markets, are going to push out adults. If you have a kid putting his widget together cheap, then an adult who has a higher wage is not going to do it. And that's actually true sometimes. I mean, you can actually go to the people study this. The problem is that the opposite is also true. In some places, the kid bringing the kid with the adult actually makes the adult more pliable because they do things together in certain kinds of crafts and so on. And now this actually raises the adult pliability. So again, it's very situational. You have to depend on what you're looking at. You're looking in Egypt or you're looking in France or wherever. You need to know what you're looking at, and then you can put this out, okay? A second way of looking at child labor is by the big economists, macroeconomists. Human capital, we're talking about forms of capital. We build human capital, we educate scientists, and they go to work, and they make more money, and they make new things for society. They make good wages, they pay taxes, the taxes support the government, all of this. So what we're trying to do with kids is raise human capital. This is the world, okay? This is what we're all about with kids in the world, okay? Then you have a third one, which I call social responsibility. And these are the people who say, geez, why do we have all these kids out on the street hustling, signing shoes and stuff? Society's breaking down. Moms and dads aren't taking care of kids, they're not out of school. This is a social dismay, this aggregation going on here. We've got to do something to try and hold society together, and you get responsibility and so forth, and then churches and Save the Children and all these sort of terrible organizations. tend to think very much along these lines. What do we do about these kids? You know, they're falling out of society. Let's bring them back in and make them a part, make them a family. Okay. Then you have a newer one that I call the children-centered view. That view says, well, let's see what happens to actual kids. Kids have rights, kids have, you know, needs, so they should be able to do this. What can we do about these kids? And they ask, see, what is best for Johnny and Susie and so forth? And then they ask those kinds of questions. In some cases, they'd be working, they'd be in school, they'd put two together. But they look at what leads to the development of this human being from younger to older. Okay? And this tends to be people involved in human rights. You know, in these kinds of areas. Nothing is wrong with any of these, but they're all very partial. Very different ways of looking at kids and work.
Oh, what point are you on now? Or are you just kind of...
I'm going to 5.
5, okay. Because at 8 o'clock we like to take a break.
Okay.
And if you want to engage us again, we can do that.
Okay. Okay.
But okay, I'm sorry.
So the final thing on that one is then the whole question if we look at from that standpoint is what's harmful for kids, what's harmless for kids, and what's beneficial for kids. So they would ask us about Jim. You know, say Jimmy, you know, is this kind of work good for you? Is this bad for you? Is this okay? Whatever it is, okay. And we have ways of looking at that, and there are people I know others who work on this. We have schema. You go out and try to look at the job and say, is this good for kids? Is this bad for kids or not? Okay. And we can empirically get at that. It affects their health, or it affects their brain, all these different kinds of things. Okay. And then out of that, you get kind of interventions. Okay.
Bill, yeah. You don't have to rush. I mean, we've eaten into the straight you talking to us time by interrupting and having some discussion.
The intervention idea, then, but depends on what you think the problem is. And in that, we have gotten into all kinds of problems. We have, going back from 1919, as part of the Versailles Treaty, virtual war, something called the International Labor Organization, for which I used to work, okay? And it has one of its mandates to abolish child labor, period. Okay? And that's one of the other things, too. This is one of its minor, but it's one of its importance objectives given to it. The whole idea came right out of the satanic meals, you know, idea that kids shouldn't work at all, okay? And it has that mandate to this day. You know, but as I mentioned earlier, there's also a lot of social science out there that says, there's nothing wrong with those kids working. A lot of them is, and we should do something about that. So you have that trying to keep kids from working, but you have a whole other group, let's call them the social scientists, saying, well, geez, okay, there are kids working in really dangerous work, they shouldn't be doing that. But let's see if we can fix the work. So if they can still do it, so let's make it shorter, let's make sure it's not dangerous, let's make sure it doesn't the more in school, you know, all the things, so can we make it so they get along together? Okay, and there are lots of people doing that. It's a very viable thing to do in some situations. In other situations, it won't work. Children should not be coming hot car drivers. Nobody probably should be doing that. I mean, you can't fix that, okay? But a lot of things you can. Maybe the kids are working someplace and they're staying just because they can touch and expose wires or something, they won't put the wires up and they're okay, you know? For doing 2 hours and something. And another thing that was found out is that they had the idea was to keep them in the family, but we'll let them go to the shop. But when we start looking at children and who is in danger, there's no relationship. Some industries think they're perfectly safe and some are dangerous as heck. And a lot of work they do in families can be really dangerous. Okay? So it's sort of not sort of, you know, you sort of got to track them back down, you know? You shouldn't have kids working with mercury. You know, whether it's in a family or whether it's, you know, it's out for somebody else, okay? So some of these easy categorizations we're thinking about just don't work, okay? Which means that we have to come to some decisions on what we're going to deal with. And here's comes human rights. This is a really important thing about children's work because there is a master framework in the world for thinking about what rights children should have. And those rights are human rights that are pulled together primarily in a large document. But it's almost that are called the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. And one of those articles deals with children's work. And it says that children should not be engaged in work that is exploitative. They don't. You define exploitative, that's a whole other thing, how to define that. That keeps them out of school, keeps them out of interfere with their schooling, okay? Or that affects, that negatively affects their physical, mental, understood as both emotional and cognitive, mental, okay? Spiritual, moral, or social development. Meaning, they look wrong. And, you know, so it's not just enough to look at one little thing, okay? And right before that is another right. It says children have a right to development at least exactly the same bunch of characteristics, you know, the physical, mental, so forth, okay? And how this taken is that kids need to work somewhat in order to have the food, in order to experience a lot. If it's developmental, then it's probably okay. But if it undermines this development, it's probably not okay. And then so the question is, how do we go out and do this? And there are ways I will go and bring it. But schooling turns out to be a key indicator that people have used for that. So, you have right now, and this is going to end up here, because you covered what I was going to say about schooling. You have a series on one hand of people, you know, in the institution saying that work gets annoying school, and therefore it should be either abbreviated or abandoned or whatever. And you have people saying that work is one of the fundamental developmental mechanisms, you know, of becoming a human being. And the anthropologists are on this side, and a bunch of lawyers are on the other side. And right now, there is an enormous debate going on. And we don't have the lawyers, and the people on the more ideological side, on the same side as the people who actually study work, the developmental psychologists, the child people, the anthropologists, sociologists, and so forth. So, the big question is, can you get them together? And I just don't want to move over again, but the paper that you looked at says yes. There are, in fact, in each of those characteristics, whether work, learning with work or learning, from work or learning through work.
Yeah.
So each of these, I gave some examples. There are people doing all of these. All of these are possible. So it is not necessary to separate children's work from their schooling, but it is necessary to really monitor it to make sure that it doesn't become exploitative or dangerous to them in these different ways. I mean, this happens, okay? You to make sure, and it also is important to make sure that the kids themselves will have a chance to give feedback, but I won't get into that. But they are very good at giving feedback on these things, so whatever they're doing. And there are people actually trying to put these two together. But our laws and whatnot at this point, around the world are standing in the way, and so we're excited to see what this comes out. Okay, that's all.